listening to Dallas Theological Seminary's Chapel Podcast.
For the benefit of our guests, I would like to introduce our president, Dr. Mark Bailey, who will be our chapel speaker today. Dr. Bailey came to Dallas Seminary in 1985 as a professor in Bible exposition, and in 1997, he was appointed vice president for academic affairs and academic dean. And then in 2001, he was named Dallas Seminary's fifth president. Mark has been actively involved in pastoral ministry and theological education for 30 years. He's conducted many tours to Israel and the Middle East and has had the opportunity to write several books and articles. Dr. Bailey and his wife Barbara have two sons, Josh, who is married to Emily, and Jeremy, and they especially enjoy their two grandchildren. I'd like you to join with me in welcoming our president, Dr. Mark Bailey.
Let me add again my welcome to those of you who are here visiting Dallas on our Focus Day. We're delighted to have you. I was in my last year at Western Seminary in my master's degree program when I was invited to speak at a youth conference in the Tri-City area, and I took a little plane on what was called Cascade Airlines, and I was flying to a famous place called Walla Walla, Washington. Portland and Seattle were mentioned earlier because of the rain and the fog and the clouds, and this was a what we called up there a pea soup foggy day. And we took off in this little plane, and it was one of those that back then there was no cockpit. It was only a curtain that separated 11 of us in this little tiny plane from the pilot and the co-pilot. And I was holding my Bible. I still remember it. It was one of the first hardback New American Standard big Bibles. I had put a padded cover over it, and it was my security pillow as I flew in this bumpy little plane as we headed to Walla Walla, Washington. As we got closer, it seemed that the fog moved in more dense, and we were not flying at a real high altitude on that particular day in that little tiny plane. But I remember the nervous conversation of the pilot and the co-pilot as we were getting ready to land and approach the landing strip at Walla Walla, Washington. They began to count down the altitude, and they were at 1,000 feet, and you still couldn't see anything. Then came 500 feet, and you still couldn't see anything. Then 300 feet, and you could still see nothing. I began thinking about my wife. We had been married just a couple of years. We had no children at the time, but the proverbial flash of your life in front of your eyes was taking place fairly rapidly. And I was thinking what I'd left behind. I'd forgotten to take an orange off the table that Barbie had left for me. But I was holding my Bible and clutching it like, if I'm going down, I'm going down with this. At about 250 feet, one of the pilots or the co-pilot said to the other, oh, baby, you know, open up. And everybody in the plane moaned, you know. And it was, at that point, nobody talked. It was quiet. And it was, we instantly knew, however, that our entire life was in the hands of one who was behind the controls of that little plane. It was a great lesson for me. And it was during that period of time that God had been working on my heart in the Psalms. And one of those Psalms that God reminded me of was a great Psalm that's many of your favorites. This is a great day at Dallas Seminary for our Focus Day. This is a great weather day at Dallas Seminary. If you listen to the news at all this morning, this is the greatest economic weekend of the year for Dallas, because it's the Texas OU weekend. And we have the invasion of those from the north who come across the Red River. And if you listen to, Randy Galloway, he would remind them that they need to take their tick baths as they cross the river before they come into our state. It is a rivalry that goes way back. They have to govern the tunnel over here at the Cotton Bowl as to which team comes out at what time, so there's no fights in the hallways and in the aisles, you know, before they come onto the field and put it all on. It's a great weekend, and it's great weather for that. It's the last weekend of the Texas State Fair. It's a very interesting set of days because if you followed the news yesterday, there was what we call now the balloon boy in Fort Collins, Colorado, who, whether it's a stunt or whether it was an accident, they're still the pundits are still trying to figure that out. But a homemade weather balloon was launched from the yard of a couple up there, thinking the six-year-old boy was in the balloon, taking off, flying some 18, 20 miles as a victim of the wind. And he ended up being in a box hiding in the attic of the garage so his dad wouldn't find him for whatever reasons. We're still not sure. If you saw the news, it's also a great day because in Melbourne, Australia, a lady left her baby in the stroller and right on the platform of a train, and she turned around and that stroller went off in front of the train. It hit the baby stroller, dragged it 31 feet, and the baby basically has a scratch on its forehead, and that's it. What a wild day. What a great weekend. And I thought, why not go to a great psalm? Because it has a great theme, and it's the theme of our God. Turn with me to Psalm 139. I have chosen to call it the mining shaft of refinement, and you'll understand why as we move into that. Probably the most famous verses of this psalm are the last two verses, Psalm 139, verses 23 and 24. Psalm 139, 23 and 24. It's become the theme of a hymn that we sing in meditation. Search me, O God. Know my heart, etc. And the psalm, those lines go like this. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there be any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. I want to take those two verses apart and then look at the psalm as an extension of that in a moment. But as you look at the first two lines, in great Hebrew parallelism, it's often called stereometrics, there's a line with a restatement of another line in great art style, imagery, poetic fashion, and they play off of each other, and there are parallel ideas that help interpret one line with the other line. And you'll notice that he starts off, search me, O God, and know my heart. When you look up that word search, you'll find that it comes out of the mining industry. It comes out of a mining shaft imagery, which basically means, God, dig me out. Dig me out. When I left seminary and started in our first ministry, we were back in my hometown of Phoenix, Arizona. And years earlier, I had visited a place called Baghdad, Arizona. You don't want to go there. Baghdad was 17 miles of dirt road off of any paved road, but we played them in basketball and football, and we went up there to minister in a youth rally, and they had a huge open pit copper mine. And it was, you looked over the edge of that copper mine, and there were what looked like toy trucks down in the bottom of that open pit copper mine. As you look, though, those trucks began to ream their way out of that pit, and by the time they got up level with you, the tires were bigger and taller than you were, and it was just a massive open pit. Well, Luther says, bold is the man who prays this kind of a prayer. God, search me. Use the pick and shovel of your life and dig me out. Search me, O God. He says, search me and know my heart, that central control panel of all of our existence, the basic center of our being, from which all of our thoughts and all of our inclinations come. It's a bold prayer to say, God, would you search me and would you really know me, know my heart? The second line is in parallel to that, and that is try me is parallel with search me. And in the mining process, after the ore had been dug out of the ground, they would then take it and they would put it on the scale to measure the difference between dirt without any ore and dirt that had ore, and they would weigh it. And the word to try is a word that basically means to place it in the balance scale and weigh it. So it's the second step in the mining process. David may be hiding from Saul. Maybe he is in conflict down in the Philistine territory near the cave of Adullam or wherever he might be. But maybe he's sitting there and maybe he's in a shaft of a mining operation in which he sees the pick and the shovel marks on the wall. Whatever the background for this psalm, he's using terms. God, dig me out and try me. And try me. And then he says, know my anxious thoughts. The parallel between heart and thoughts is pretty immediate as far as in English is concerned. I remember when I first looked up this term, I looked it up in this doorstop of a volume called BDB, affectionately, Brown, Driver, and Briggs. And I'm sure there's been some new edits of this book and some revisions of this book. But as I looked up this word, and if you wanted to know, it's in this volume, it's on page 972. And when you look up this noun, it has the idea of branches, branching out. And I thought, I've been away from Hebrew a little too long. And I thought, I think I looked up the wrong word. So I actually closed the book when I first looked this word up, and I opened it again and started over thinking I had missed something somewhere, because that was a far cry from anxious thoughts. But I hadn't made a mistake. I've made plenty of other kinds of mistakes, but I hadn't made a mistake, and I'd looked at the right page, and it's 972. It's the first full entry on the left column, and it gives you that root idea that has the idea of divide, And branching out or becoming involved. And then my days in X-ray technology that I had behind me before I went to seminary, and while I was in seminary, and my master's and my doctoral work, I suddenly go, oh, okay, I understand now. Because if you were to open the anatomy where the heart and the feeling of our emotions lie, you would not only apart that cadaver, but you would see what looked like a several sets of branches in the human body. In fact, in the circulatory system, it's called the brachial. In the lung system, it's called the bronchial. Both words have their idea in branches. And in the Hebrew parallel, what he's saying is, God, search me and know my heart. Weigh me out, try me, and know those involved, entangled, branching ideas of my life. The root idea has the word branches, but the usage which determines the meaning best to translate is this concept of involved or anxious, entangled thoughts. I don't know about you, but when I face something that is ominous, my earlobes don't bother me. You know, I don't go, oh, my aching earlobe. When I get nervous, I don't go, whoa, my forearm is really bothering me. See, if it's a real issue, it's right here in the pit. It's you know, plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is, you know, to get Rolaids or a Zantac or something like that. Acid indigestion, it's in the visceral part of our being that the anxiety manifests itself. We talk about having butterflies, and we don't think of those in our foot. We think of them right here in the visceral area of feeling of our life. So he says, search me, oh God, know my heart. Try me, and in parallel to the heart, know those anxious, if I can say it, branching, fleeting thoughts. God, you know what bothers me the most. You know what raises the anxiety levels of my life. You know the fears, you know the intimidations, you know the wonderment, you understand the puzzlement I face in making decisions as to maybe where to move or where to go to school or what course to take this next semester as we have started our registration process. Which channel shall I watch tomorrow? I know it's the Texas OU, but I really want to watch Florida play football, because Tim Tebow's sister graduated from Dallas Seminary, and I had the privilege of going to seminary with his dad. So I've become a Florida fan by osmosis, by proxy, but I'll watch it any chance I get. What are the anxious thoughts that are taking you out on those branches and leaves and windy kinds of situations? Now, if you look at that, there's one little phrase that has no parallel. It doesn't need a parallel to be understood in the passage. Could be repeated, and that's, "Oh God." But see, that's the person to whom he addresses this very bold prayer. So I want you to go back with me, and I want you to look at verse 1, because notice the parallel between verse 23 and verse 1. "Oh Lord, thou hast searched me," and literally, "known." Me is understood. "You have searched me, and you have come to full knowledge of me." You have searched me. See, on the basis of what he will say in this opening section is the basis on which he will pray at the end of this psalm. "Lord, you have searched me, and you have known me." Now, I want you to see this. He begins to identify an attribute. See if you can pick it out as we go through it. "Thou dost know when I sit down and when I rise up." In other words, you know my resting time, you know my rising time. "Thou dost understand my thought from afar." "Thou dost scrutinize," literally winnow is the word that's used to rake it over. You scrutinize my path and my lying down, my public life, and even the private life. In fact, that last phrase is even used in the most intimate of moments between a married couple in the marriage bed. God, you know me when I'm out in public. You know when I'm in private. "Thou art intimately," I guess so, if he knows all of that, "thou art intimately acquainted with all of my ways." Now watch, even before there is a word on my tongue, "Behold, O Lord, thou dost know it all." When my second son was born, my first son, Josh, who graduated from here, was 5, and he went with me to the hospital because my wife had had a C-section. And he, being a curious 5-year-old, wanted to know, how did the baby come? And my wife, very discreetly, she pulled her sheet down and her gown up just to expose that small section of where they did the incision for a C-section, for a cesarean delivery. Now, my son wasn't bothered by the big scar, but there was a little scar right above the navel where Barbie had had ovarian cysts in her early days of our marriage, and they had done a laparoscopy, a little tiny incision. It wasn't the big one, but my son looked at the little one and shocked us all when he said, pardon my vernacular, this is what he said, "What the hell is that?" We were shocked as you are right now that I would even be so strange as to say something like that from this pulpit. And my instinct was, "What did you say?" And he started to say it again. And I said, "Don't say that." And he didn't learn that from us. We don't use that kind of language in that kind of way. But somehow, somewhere, with his buddies in the nursery with the deacon's kids, he had picked up the word. So we had a conversation. That's not a word that you use like that. And so the next time we were in church, he was sitting beside me, and the pastor used the word hell from the pulpit. And my son went, "Oh, no, you know. Daddy, he used that word." So we had a theological lesson that there is a word in which it has a good context, and there's a place in which you don't use that word. Now, that was Josh, and he was 5, and we excused that. But all of us have had times where we have, maybe not a swear word, but a cross word or a word we'd love to have had a rope on and pulled back into our mouth. We would have loved to say, God, why did I say that? I don't know why. But God does. Even before there is a word on my tongue, the psalmist says, behold, thou dost know it all. And some wonder whether God knows the future. This one would say yes. Before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, thou dost know it all. Thou hast enclosed me, literally besieged me. It was a term that was used in warfare. Now watch this, I love this. Thou hast enclosed me behind and before. Notice, there's a hand in front, a hand in back. And then thou hast laid thy hand upon me. That's three hands. Before, after, on top of. Only God can do that. But thou hast besieged me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. And then he says, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's too high. I can't attain to it. Well, it's not hard to figure out the major theme and the attribute that's highlighted in this section. And that is that God is omniscient. What that means is that God knows everything there is to know, both now and forever. If he knows what's going to happen before I ever say it, he knows. Well, put it negatively, then there is nothing that God does not know. If God knows everything there is to know, then there's nothing that God does not know. And now let's make it personable. That means God knows us, God knows you, and God knows me intimately. He's intimately acquainted with all of our ways. God knows me when I want him to know me. Problem is, God also knows me when I don't want him to know me. Because he knows everything about us. Look at the next paragraph. Where can I go from thy spirit? Or where can I flee from thy presence? If I ascend to heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there thy hand will lead me and thy right hand will lay hold of me. Now, these are spatial relationships. See, this is the where question. If I go up, he's there. If I go down, he's there. Why? He upholds all things by the word of his power. That includes heaven and hell. That includes the grave. It includes the afterlife for the saints. God is there. I can't get away from him. Even if I wanted to. If I go up, you're there. If I go down, you're there. Now watch this. If I take the wings of the dawn, what direction is the dawn? East. Okay? Phenomenologically speaking, the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. So if I take the wings of the dawn, if I fly as far east as I can go, or, he says, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, think Israel, think west, you just took a bath in the Mediterranean. If I go to the remotest part of the sea, when heaven and earth at the horizon come together as far east, you go to Tel Aviv and look west, you can't see anything out there as far as land is concerned. That's the remotest part of the sea. If I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, notice, even there your hand will lead me and thy right hand will lay hold of me, that powerful hand. There is nowhere I can go where God is not. Now that's spatial relationships. But there's a space-time continuum. So what about time? Look at the next verse. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, and the light around me will be night, even the darkness is not too dark to thee, and the light is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to thee. Can I tell you something this morning? 12 o'clock. Midnight or noon is 12 o'clock to God. Makes no difference. When I was real little, we moved to a little place called Carbondale, Arizona. We lived in the upstairs apartment of a two-story building, and there were two apartments on the upper level, and we were in one of them as a family, and my dad worked on the worked for the Colorado Game and Fish Department, and he worked on the fish hatchery in Carbondale, raising fish, trout, and things like that to plant in the high streams and lakes of Colorado. Grew up riding shotgun on a fish truck. At least we knew where the fish were, though. And it was great. But I remember being home before I ever went to full day of school. I still remember spending some days with my mother. I got locked in an old ice box. They had drilled holes in it just for stupid kids like me. And I got locked in for 4 hours one morning in the garage. I had got in, thought it was a car, closed the door just for fun, and the latch went down, and I got lost from everybody for 4 hours. It started me on a road to a little bit of being claustrophobic, you know, about closed spaces. And But I remember Mom ultimately finding me, and the guy who took care of the fish hatchery, sort of the foreman of the fish hatchery, had come through, and they found me, and I was a mess, and I was scared. And I remember staying home with my mom like on days like that, and on one day, she was talking way too long on the phone to her friend Marilyn, a fellow telephone operator that she had led to the Lord. And I wanted Mom's attention, so I decided to get it. And what looked like a huge long hallway probably wasn't even from here to the front of this platform. But for a little guy, it was a huge long hallway. And I went out and sort of just stuck my tongue out at my mother. Sort of like, take that. She looked at me with those motherly mean eyes that are intended to discipline you before she ever gets to you. And I ran back in the back room. I got in the back closet. I pulled the doors out, got behind the clothes, and I just sat there and panted. She'll never find me. Nothing happened. I opened the doors, and I looked out, and she wasn't there. And so I went back out in the room, went down and looked down the hall, and there she is, sort of looking at me from, you know, on the phone, talking to Marilyn while I'm there. And so I decided, well, if that didn't get her attention, let's go one step farther. So I not only stuck out my tongue, I gave her one of the high fives with that. You know, you say, that's pretty innocent. Well, for that was pretty daring for, you know, a four-year-old. And she shook her fist at me. And I thought, I'm dead. And I went back in there, closed the door, got behind the clothes, and I'm panting. She'll never find me. I did one more round of that. Got back in the closet. I'm panting. I'm thinking, I'm dead now. It's gonna be short-lived. And all of a sudden, I opened the door, and there she stood. Right there. And that's when I knew moms were omnipresent, you know, not just God. And she gave me my choice of a hairbrush, a belt on my behind, or a flip on the mouth. Well, I'd had the belt on the behind, and I'd had the hairbrush, so I chose the flip on the mouth, and that was probably the greatest discipline, because I knew it had hurt her, and it hurt me to know I'd hurt her, and so I'll never forget the day. She laughs about it now. I still shiver. No. But did you catch the attribute? I hope you did. Because God is not only omniscient, he's omnipresent. Whether it's space or time, it doesn't matter. Whether it's midnight or noon, it doesn't matter. God is everywhere there is to be. If God is everywhere there is to be all of the time, then there is nowhere where God is not. Which means this, folks, for you and for me, God is with us imminently. We speak of the transcendence of God, and we speak of the immanence of God. But the presence of God, because it's omnipresence, is never apart from us. Now, we can separate in the relationship, and that's why the Bible exhorts us in the prophets and repeats in the New Testament, draw near to God and he'll draw near to you. It's not because he was gone. It's a term of relationship and fellowship. Because I can't get away with him. If I go to heaven and he's there, and if I go to hell and he's there, if I go east and he's there, if I go west and he's there, midnight or noon, it doesn't matter, behind a clothes, inside a box, inside a closet, it doesn't matter. God is everywhere there is to be, all of the time. And that's why he's near, imminently near. Now God is with me when I want him to be. God is also with me when I don't want him to be. It's a comfort and it's a conviction all at the same time. Well, look at verse 13. For thou didst form my inward parts. Literally, thou didst create my inward parts. Thou didst weave me, it's a good translation, didst weave me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Now, he doesn't give us the percentages. of fearful versus wonderful. But we're fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are thy works, the psalmist says. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from thee when I was literally tailored in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Thine eyes have seen my unformed, literally embryonic, egg-shaped substance. And in thy book they were all written, the days that were ordained for me. Now watch this. Does he know the future? Is he present? When as yet there was not one of them. God knows. In fact, God has created and God has planned the calendar of your life and mine. Now, there's a lot of mystery to that. There's a lot of mystery when there is anomalies of birth. There's a lot of mysteries when there is infant death. There's a lot of mysteries when somebody is born with brain damage and lives with that their entire life. There's a lot of unanswered things that will have answered the first nanosecond in heaven. But when I read this text, I learn a whole lot. How wonderful, he says, are thy thoughts. Look at verse 17. How precious also are thy thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I would count them, as they would outnumber the sand. Now, I love this. When I wake, I'm still with thee. What's happened to him? He started counting the wonderful thoughts of God and fell asleep. That old movie, I forget which it is, Bing Crosby, was pretty theologically right when he says, when you're worried and you can't sleep, just count your blessings instead of sheep and you'll fall asleep, counting your blessings. And when you wake up, keep the calculator going, because he's still with you and you're still with him. Now, what is he saying about this? God is not only omnipresent and omniscient, he's omnipotent. He's all-powerful. He has made everything that exists and everyone who exists. The cross-references with this passage that talks about it as an illustration in the human procreation aspects. John 1, Christ is the personal agent of creation that matches Romans 1 and Colossians 1, Hebrews 1, other passages throughout the scriptures in that creativity and ability of God. But he's made everything that exists. There is nothing that he has not made. By him all things have come together, and by him all things are sustained and subsist. Well, to let's make it personal, God has created us intricately. We're learning more and more about that. One of our faculty members, Dr. Lanier Burns, was talking to us about some of the experiences he had this last year on his sabbatical in the field of the linkage between biblical theology and neuroscience. And we're all sitting there, eyes are starting to glaze over with the technicalities and the intricacies of his description of what he found out. But you marvel of what God has continued to allow humanity to discover about the intricacies of his creation and how things work and why things are like they are. Well, he goes on with a little imprecatory statement, I think, when he sees how great God is, and then he realizes the kind of people with whom he lives on planet Earth. He says, oh, that thou wouldst slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, men of bloodshed. Verse 19, for they speak against thee wickedly, and thine enemies take thy name in vain. In other words, with God having such a high place in the psalmist's mind, he's going, boy, it wouldn't be good if we were just rid of all this other stuff. He says, do I not hate those that hate thee, O Lord? Now, you got to put this with the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says, love your enemies and pray for those that persecute you. Where he ups the ante for a Christian response and a Christ-like response and a God-like response to these kind of people. But in a holy war environment, do I not hate those that hate thee, O Lord? Do I not loathe those that rise up against thee? I hate them with an utmost hatred. They've become my enemies. And I think the psalmist may be in this mining shaft of God searching him and digging him out and trying him and putting him on the balance scale. He's thinking about his own life. He's thinking about God and he's thinking about the enemies. And it's sort of like, Lord, it's you and me. Would you take care of them? And then I have a feeling that he had a second thought. God, if that's what I'm wanting you to do with them, what am I wanting you to do with me? Oh, God, search me. Search me and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts. And then verse 24, see if there be a hurtful way in me. See if there's something in me that would cause harm to myself, cause harm to others, that just which wouldn't be kosher with your character. And then in good antithetical parallelism, he says, would you lead me the other way? Would you lead me in the way everlasting? See, the third step in the mining process was not only that they would dig it out, not only would they put it on the balance scales, but then they would inspect it and see if there were any flaws. You who have recently been married or been engaged, you understand that process, where you go to the jeweler and you pick out a stone and then they ask you to look at it and the cut and the clarity and all the other C's that go into the evaluation of a diamond. And you see with that inspection, are there any flaws in there? What? How did that degrade the value of that stone? And the psalmist is asking God, would you see if there's any flaws in me? And if you find any flaws in me, Lord, would you lead me in exactly the opposite way? Would you lead me in the derech olam, is the Hebrew expression, the way that is characterized by God in everlasting life? That's what the psalmist wants. You see, when we put this together, God's discernment of our life, notice the terms, search me, try me, see me. It's that is the foundational then for God to give direction to our lives. And in this context, while there's great parallelism between the first two lines and the last two lines, as a unit, there's three statements of discernment and one statement of direction. God, take me in the other direction. Lead me in the way that leads to you. When I was in Portland, I worked for Portland Adventist Hospital. I was an X-ray technologist. And in crazy faith, I went in and said, I'd like to work from Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock till midnight on Saturday night. I need to be off on Sunday, and I need to be off Monday through Friday because I need to go to school. And I was young enough to be crazy enough, and they said, well, we don't have a shift like that. I said, I know. He said, well, we'll call you if we need you. About 2 hours later, I was sitting at home, and he called. His name was Val Jean Devity. He was the head tech at the X-ray department. He said, do you really want to work Friday afternoon till midnight Saturday night? I said, yeah, it's the only time I can work. He said, you know we're an Adventist hospital. I said, I saw that. He said, do you know what that means? I said, I think so. He said, we don't like working Saturdays. That's our Sabbath. We take that day off. That's an off day at the Adventist hospital. That's like Saturday at another hospital or Sunday at another hospital. We don't work on that day. Would you work on that day? I said, I would love to work on that day. And I began to work. One afternoon, Friday afternoon, I left the seminary and I drove over to the hospital and went in and put on my smock and got ready to take x-rays. He said, Mark, I need you to come here. And I said, we've just gone, and this was in the early days of computerization. He said, we've just installed a computer. And I said, really? Because I don't know how to type. And he said, yeah. He says, you know, you remember you had to used to go to the file cabinet in the 3x5 file card, and you had to find whether that patient had been here before when a new patient came in, and you had to look that up. I said, yeah. He said, we don't have to do that anymore. All we have to do is put the patient's name in the computer and push SE, which stands for search. And it'll immediately track that record, and you'll have instantly on the screen whether or not we've ever taken x-rays of that person. I said, man, that's great. That'll save us time. He said, that's what we thought. So he said, now I need to teach you the second function. He said, if somebody wants to know what exams have been done on that patient, you plug in that patient's name and you put EX in, and then you hit the program key, the go key, and that will bring out all of the examinations that patient has ever had at Portland Adventist Hospital. Whether they've had a chest x-ray or an upper GI, we've got a list of all of that. That's phenomenal. We used to have to hike down, go into the bowels of the hospital, look through the files, you know, scary in the middle of the night to do that, and come back out with those x-rays and bring them for the radiologist or the doctor who would like to look at them. We now have a record. We know exactly whether they're there or not. He says, yeah, that's why we did it. I said, what's the next function? He said, it's called PR. It's not public relations. It's printout. And he says, if the doctor wants the report on those exams that were done on that patient, you put the patient's name in, you hit the exam, you push the PR key, and down at the end of the hall in triplicate, you know, on a sprocket drive, you hear, and a printout is coming out with three copies of that report from the radiologist. One goes to their doctor, one goes to the radiologist, one goes to the files. I said, that's terrific. That'll save us all kinds of time. And then I had a panic thought. I don't know how to type. And I said, Val, I said, what happens if I make a mistake? He said, Mark, we've thought about you. I said, what is it? He said, if you make a mistake, all you have to do is enter that back in and push DE. That stands for delete. And whatever mistake you made will be erased. But he said, now careful, because it'll be permanently erased. So he says, be careful how you use that key. Years later, I thought, search. Examine. Print out. See. God, have you made provision for me? And God would say, I've made provision for you all. If you confess your sins, he's faithful and just to forgive you of your sins and to delete the record of all unrighteousness, to forgive you, cleanse you. The psalmist, because of what he thinks about God, has thoughts of protecting the reputation of God, but he also has thoughts that if he's going to be qualified to help protect the reputation of God and honor God as God, he knows that God has to desperately work in his own life. Because we're desperate without him. Father, thank you for making provision not only to know us, thank you for being with us. No one knows us like you know us because you made us, and no one has the capacity to change us and to change not only our eternal, but even our temporal direction in a way that would go toward you like you can. May we be more conscious and more committed to let you do this in our lives, we pray. Every day. In Jesus' name. Amen. God bless you. Have a wonderful weekend. It's a great day. You're dismissed.